Did I talk about the argument we had on the train with the plainclothesman?
No.
I thought I might have, but
this was in Japan.
Yeah. We had to report. We traveled all over Japan.
Yeah.
North, east, south, right down to the southern islands, Nagasaki and all. It was kind of a tour of Japan for the first time,
mm-hmm.
as adult. I've been there before, but I was too young to remember much of it. But this time we had to report everywhere we went. And we report to their equivalent to the FBI. And they'd always send two men with us to travel together.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to know why we're going, what are you going to do, what's the purpose of the trip. And so it was just a pain in the ass. We weren't that free. I guess they were watching us fairly closely. I was 19, I guess, when I went over. It was 19. My kid brother was 13.
Hmm.
And they'd ask, how old are you? And he says, 13. He says, you lie. my kid brother was 13, but God, he was big.
He was tall. Man.
Yeah, he was tall. Stood head shoulder above the Japanese police. But it's kind of sad. They had so very little, and they're so misled. They were so misled that they thought they were doing right, and they didn't know.
Yeah.
But we traveled and tell them where we're going, and they'll be on the train with us. And when we come to any scenic spot or what looked like scenic spot, they'll come over and pull the shade down. Mother would go and push it up. They'd come back down and pull it down. The shade went up and down a couple of times, and it was a farce. But mother was tough.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Yeah, she was in this country. My math is awfully bad, but from 41 to 1919 is when she came over. 22 years. In 22 years' time, she had gotten tough enough to fight back.
Mm-hmm.
And they did not know how to handle a woman who talked back, who fought back, and took hands in her. You know, it was a military state.
Oh, yeah.
Run by the Japanese military. Men first. I couldn't even go into the kitchen for a glass of water. You know, it was a entirely different kind of, you know, people are very nice, naive, simple, and very charming.
Mm-hmm.
But you get into areas like that, they have beliefs that influence their thinking. And that was one that was very hard to reconcile.
Yeah.
But by the time the shade would go up and down a few times, and, you know, the shade would stay up. But we'd pass whatever we were supposed to see, you know, whether it was scenic or defense plant or whatever
right.
it was. Anyway, that was one thing that was very memorable, that we had run-in with the cops there all the time.
Yeah.
But Japan was tough. Mother got to a point where she just didn't want to go back to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
But the freedom with which you live here, so different. You take it for granted after a while.
Mm-hmm.
You take everything for granted.
Did she ever make it back to Japan after the
war? Oh yeah, she's been back several times afterwards. She swore she wouldn't go back, but she did. Economically, it's feasible because it's...
Sure.
One country has a lot and the other doesn't have much.
Mm-hmm.
So you always had to have that advantage.
Was the treatment different on her return trips?
Oh yeah. The natives are nice. I see my cousins. I see them quite a bit. They come over, we go over. I have a cousin who's the same age as I am. He's my dad's older brother's youngest son.
Mm-hmm.
And we get along. We still correspond. Not much anymore, but used to.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard. You're fulfilling functions that hangs down from the family, you know. I didn't particularly sought the friendship of my cousins, but it was nice that we were able to show them what we have here in the States, how we mm-hmm. live and how they live. It's quite different.
Mm.
Quite different. The values are different.
Sure.
But that's so much for Japan.
Yeah.
It's a good influence. But in San Francisco, there's some carryover to that. We lived right in Japantown,
mm-hmm.
Right across the street from the Japanese language school.
Is that right?
So I went to Japanese language school for 16 years. Well, until I was out of high school.
Right.
You go to high school and then you come back and go to Japanese school. And you learn the language, and the language is quite complex. There's a different character that you have to memorize. We only have 26 alphabet in the alphabet.
Right.
And there's thousands and thousands in Japanese dictionary, different characters. And it's just a memory course to learn how to read. I went 16 years, but not as a serious student,
mm-hmm.
mainly because a lot of your friends went there.
Right.
Well, that was my background, dual impulse.
Right. What can you tell me about Dinuba? You were telling me that you guys went there first before the camp in Phoenix.
Well, we knew that the evacuation was coming. Evacuation was clearing these West Coast states, Washington, Oregon, California, of all Japanese. Clear them, round them up, and put them into camps.
Mm-hmm.
And to that end, they were going to build 10 different camps in godforsaken areas. Post in Arizona, Gila River, Arizona. You never heard of these places.
Yeah.
Amachi, Colorado. I guess it's Colorado. Topaz, Utah. Where else? Oh. 10 of these things, and we were to be rounded up and assembled in different areas almost immediately, and then when the camps are ready, that will be moved over to the campsite. So there was one first set called the assembly centers,
mm-hmm.
where you were first gathered and put into camp, and then from assembly centers you were put into these relocation centers. The relocation centers were the real camps that you see now.
I see.
They're all built out of 1x6s.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not double wall construction, but just a single wall. And
yeah.
God, it was hot as hell. We were there. I went to the one in Arizona. I skipped the assembly center because we voluntarily moved. They said California will be divided into two areas. Highway 99 that runs right through the center of California. If you're west of it, you're going to get evacuated. If you're east of it, you can spend the war years and be free like you were living in Nevada.
Wow.
Or Utah or anywhere else in the States.
Yeah.
Hey, you live your war. We can't do much there. But in the proximity of the West Coast, you're going to get evacuated. So we move voluntarily, hired Beacon's moving van to move us from San Francisco to Dinuba. There's another farmer friend of Dad. And we had a nice cottage and got there, and they got there very early in 42. I didn't join them until September or August, sometime around then, July maybe.
Yeah.
When school let out at Cal, I went back in 42 of spring 42. But first, they put a travel restriction. We could not move, from our home base. And that put a tramp on Dad because he had to see.
That was his life.
Yeah, he had to drive around and see how the farm's doing. Hmm. So he illegally drove at night to get from place to place. And he would now cross that bridge, not cross the bridge at all because it would be a toll booth.
Hmm.
He'd be stopped and you have to pay a 2-bit toll of 50 cents. It was a 2-bit toll at that time.
Yeah.
We said that he pays that 2-bit toll, but this minute we pay up the bridge, cost of the bridge, it'd be free. The hell it was. Double, triple, quadruple. Just went up until it's, I don't know how much it is now, $4 or $5 a crossing.
Yeah.
Anyway, he drove all the way down to San Jose and then around.
Oh, really?
To avoid
the bridge. Wow.
But things were different. Took a lot of things for granted and other things you had to improvise. But we were given 3-4 days notice once they decide to move us. The San Francisco area first went to Tanforan racetracks.
Mm.
And that was bad because most of the evacuation centers and a moment's notice were at fairgrounds.
Right.
And racetracks and the available spaces are the horse barns. Horse and cows, you move them out and move people in. And you sleep with cow shit and all.
Yeah.
Horrible. We didn't do that. We moved to Dinuba and spent the war years, first few months there. But eventually it got to the point where we had to go to camp, and we got on this train that took us to Arizona. You get on these trains, you don't know where the hell you're going. They don't tell you where.
Huh.
They tell you to be prepared for cold or hot. And this place was hot. God, it was hot. Jeez. Arizona. But this is where the Havasu Indian Reservation in Parker Dam was located. And we went there.
So how long were you guys in that camp, all told?
Well, I was there. Maybe a month, maybe less than a month.
Oh, really?
Okay. I was the first one out of camp.
Wow.
Out of our camp. It was a camp of about 20,000 people. But I went in with a stack of letters, maybe 2.5 inches high, applying to all kind of different architectural schools. I wanted to finish up. and I had acceptance from two or three of those.
Yeah. Berkeley was no longer an option.
No. Oh, hell no, you couldn't stay there.
Yeah.
None of the West Coast, the state, you know, state, Washington, Seattle, Portland, all of Oregon, all of California were evacuated. Nobody stayed here. Hmm. Well, there were some exceptions. There are some exceptions like Keeney, my wife's sister, was working, she was bilingual,
mm-hmm.
and was working as an interpreter and translating a lot of the documents. And she was able to stay, I think she stayed a little here on the West Coast. But they had a military intelligence school, MIS.
Mm.
Military intelligence school that they set up in San Francisco, where they trained Niseis like myself,
right,
in the language to brush up on enough to be useful as interpreters. And that was in San Francisco for a while until they moved it. What the hell did they move it? I don't know. Inland.
Yeah.
So it started in San Francisco. And they're trying to resurrect that as a monument.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think there's some movement going on now.
Hmm.
Military intelligence school.
So you applied to several different schools on Midwest and
East. Yeah, and then I was accepted to Harvard and to Washington University. And Harvard was a little prohibitive in terms of cost. I had enough in school savings to go to Washington U, and like a dumb fool, I went to Washington U. First thing I do is move into the dormitory, eat all my meals out, pay my tuition, and after about a year and a half, I'm running low on cash, and I tell my dad to write to him. He's in camp, and he says, tough. He suggests that I work for my room and board. That's a big, major expense. Which meant I had to get out of the dorm and work in some family, some house doing menial work to pay for my room and board.
Right.
But I did that. I did that. And
it's hard work.
The first one was tough work. Tough work. Armstrong, Fred and Florence Armstrong. St. Louis. He was a lawyer,
uh-huh.
and she wrote for the Globe Democrat. Very nice people, and nice conversations with them, but there was a difference. I had to work, and it was hot. God, they gave me the room up in the attic.
Oh, wow.
Boy, that was hot up there. I kept a tub full of lukewarm water.
Uh-huh.
And I'd be naked. I soak in it, and I throw a wet towel over my body, and I come out and study up in the attic. No air conditioning.
It's a series of hot accommodations that you've been having.
But that was it. And finally, friends I talked to, well, you know, you go to these schools, there are not too many schools accepting us.
Right.
So a lot of people concentrate and go there, and there are about a dozen, maybe two dozen, of Niseis there.
In the architecture program?
No.
Yeah.
Throughout the school.
I see.
And we'd get together and talk about what we went through and what's happening, and this was part of it. But they found me a better job.
Oh, they did. The Armstrongs.
Left the Armstrong, and went on to a Jewish family called Friedman's.
Mm-hmm.
William Stick, STIX Stick, William Stick, Friedman and Helene. Very nice couple. They had adopted a Polish refugee. And we're rearing it as her own child.
Hmm.
never childless. But my prime function was to sit with her.
Is that right?
Babysit.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they could go out. You know, it was easy. They had maids. They cooked for me. And
oh, really?
So yeah, it was quite different. And I worked out in the yard and made a victory garden for them.
I see.
And
those were quite popular at that time, right?
Yeah. Because you couldn't, you know, it was hard to buy good produce.
Yeah.
But I was able to fertilize it and irrigate it, you know, you dig ditches. And I guess I worked out in a farm enough. I watched what my dad was doing to a point where I could make these things. And since I had nothing else to do, I made a victory garden. Yeah. And we grew tomatoes. All tomatoes were wonderful. They grew so big, so fast. But that was my war years.
Yeah.
And camp life in Washington, it wasn't bad. They were surprised that we got thrown out of California.
Really?
They didn't know about the evacuation.
On the East Coast and the West?
No, they didn't. No, they didn't. And they were surprised that, as citizens, why didn't you fight back? Fight back, good God.
It's easier said than done.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
But times change. Same people, attitude changes.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Well, that was Washington University. I liked it very much. And I studied. Oh, God, I studied.
Yeah.
At Armstrong's, I wouldn't go upstairs without an empty basket, waste basket, and I wouldn't come down without a full one. I mean, it was just, time was that precious.
Yeah.
But I cooked. I did the laundry, I cleaned the house, all for room and board.
Wow. So how about your architecture studios? What did you do there?
That gave me religion too, because architecture there were quite different from what I had learned at Cal. Cal was kind of a Beaux-Arts school.
Yeah.
A lot of drawings. Things that you did was aesthetics was very important.
Mm-hmm.
At Washington U, everything was logical. Function is the word that came into being, and what it began to have some significance in terms of meanings. So, you know, a bus station and a church are two different buildings. They're going to look different.
Yeah.
Even though the space might be similar. So you began to get oriented towards architectural thinking. Dennis Murphy and Eugene Mackey.
Those were two of your professors there.
They're very good. There were others, but those were the two outstanding ones. Top design.
Yeah.
And I used to correspond with them quite recently, until recently. And then I worked with them.
Oh, is that
after
right?
After I got back. Yeah, they helped me.
When you came back to California?
En route back, from when I left. When was that now? When I left?
About 1960s? 61?
Yeah, that's it. 60s. I was on my own then.
Yeah.
And they helped. They gave me a job. We worked on it together.
Oh, no kidding.
St. Louis Housing.
Huh.
It's the first time that we did a four-story housing. It was a two-story apartment on top of a two-story apartment. And you could walk two floors up to the third floor, but once you're in your third floor, having another floor for your own use.
Just apartment,
So we were able to get a fairly dense population there.
And that was in St. Louis?
In St. Louis. Very nice there.
So how did you go from there to on to Cranbrook?
Well, I did very well at YSNU.
Yeah.
But I got religion, and I began to see what architecture was all about.
Yeah.
And I won a fellowship, a scholarship there. And then from there I went to Cranbrook on a fellowship. Fellowship included room, board, and tuition.
Uh-huh.
And I got to Cranbrook 43, 44.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. 44 maybe. It was interesting. It was primarily infested with young ladies. Men were off somewhere else. Yeah. And I was excluded from that. But it was a... God, I had a ball there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I still... You know, it's interesting. There's a gal, and I used to date a girl pretty seriously at Cranbrook. And maybe I shouldn't say all this. It's got nothing to do with architecture.
It's quite interesting, though.
Yeah, yeah. She's still alive. And
oh, really?
I saw her a couple of times.
No kidding.
Yeah, went to Seattle. I looked her up. Kimi was still alive then.
Uh-huh.
And then we saw each other at Portland at another mutual Cranbrook graduate's house. But Cranbrook was small.
Yeah.
Small and intimate, and you got to know people real well.
Right.
And that was the first blossoming, I guess. I always felt second-class citizen in the States.
Mm-hmm.
I was never myself, except at Cranbrook I began to open up. It was free in that sense. People accepted you.
Right.
And you could be your own, and I bloomed there. It was a good school. I still remember going there on the fellowship in hot summer, tail end of summer, I guess, autumn, fall. And I'd go to my studio and wait for Saarinen. He never came around. I was studying with Saarinen.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like any other school where you have a definite class and the teacher comes and you get assigned.
Not so rigid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I asked one of the older fellows there, what the hell am I expected to do here? I'm here on a fellowship. Yeah. You know, full room, board, tuition, whatever it was. They're going to take that away from me. And if I'm not functioning here. So they suggested I go see Saarinen, who had a studio right next door. He lived there.
Yeah, yeah.
Right in Cranbrook. He has his house and studio. So I put on my tie and dressed up and knocked on his door. And I introduced myself. It was the first time I really met Saarinen. And he says, oh, yes, yes, I know about you. Come on in. We sat and we had a martini.
That's a good introduction.
Yeah, yeah. He says, now that you're here on a year's fellowship, what do you want to study? You know, that was a question that came to me so point blank. It never occurred to me that I wanted to study anything. You know, you go to school and you're told what to do.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They give you a problem. So, for the next 6 weeks, you're going to be doing this and that and that. You know, they have this all outlined. None of that. What do you want to do? And it caught me by surprise.
Yeah.
What do I want to do? I want to study architecture, but that's so goddamn general. But I recall that Saarinen had published the Crow Island School.
Very famous.
Yeah. And I was doing a lot of schools, and so I said, you know, I like to study schools.
Yeah.
Kids are all in the military, but they'll be coming back. They'll have this influx of students and kids, and I like to be able to design and fit into this project.
Yeah.
And so I says, great. Have you read so and so and so and so? You know, just read a couple of books, you know, yeah. Well, I've seen them. I never heard of it before in my life. There's no one. There's all these suggests that I do. And, but he knew I was just talking.
Sure.
He was interested in planning.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I studied for the next year and a half, planning.
Right.
And it was fun. It was great. I enjoyed it very much. I got a lot out of it. But at that time, planning was very difficult because the laws in this country at that time was favoring individual rights.
Right.
A woman or a man, or if he was a individual, he could say, no, I don't want to sell. I'm gonna live here, and to hell with you.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole city would have to work around them.
Not so much eminent domain then.
No, right? You can't. Yeah. You didn't have that power.
Yeah.
Well, at least we didn't know about it. So it was kind of a frustrating thing to get into.
Yeah.
Planning. You needed everybody's cooperation, everybody's property, and begin to work with it as a whole. But individual could just put such a stumbling block. I didn't think that planning was something that I wanted to delve into much more.
Mm-hmm.
But I did well in planning.
Yeah.
I did the master plan for Detroit, which was, and that's why it was easy to go into Chicago and do the city plan competition in Chicago. The general population growth factors, economy, agriculture, industrial, all of that. Detroit, Chicago, not that far apart.
Yeah.
State of Michigan kind of cuts across it, but other than that, they're both located on the lakefront. So it was easy to adapt there. So when we got into the Chicago competition, it was easy to take the research that I did for Detroit and translated into that for Chicago.
Right. And you guys did quite well in that competition.
Yeah, we did well.
Yeah.
But that was right after I had gotten my master's and I was out of school when the competition came. And we formed a team, Terry Wall, David Gear, and myself. There were three of us.
Uh-huh.
And we won the first prize on the highway, freeway design, and the grand master plan.
So you had two sections.
Yeah,
that you
yeah we had total $11,000.
That's an incredible sum then.
It was a lot of money. Hell of a lot of money. And they treated us well.
Yeah.
Chicago Herald Tribune. Herald Tribune, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
That was 1945. So that's how I got into Senator's office. I moved right from graduating from Wise Cranbrook. I worked into Senator's office.
Is that right?
That was nice.
But after the competition, you guys decided to go out on your
well,
own?
Well, we got Terry Wall. He was 10 years old than I was.
Uh-huh.
He was my fellow classmate from South Africa. And we formed a partnership with Runnels, David Runnels, also a Cranbrook graduate.
Huh.
He was about 2-3 years ahead of us. and he was in Kansas City, and he was able to get some work there. And so we went to Kansas City and formed a partnership. Reynolds, Clark, Wall, and Matsumoto.
Who is Clark?
Ingram Clark. He lived in Kansas City.
Uh-huh.
So that was a plan to do something. We did a house for him in Kansas City. It was published in Pencil Points or Progressive Architecture, I guess, whatever you call it. Jim Clark. They're all dead now. So I can say anything. You can't contradict me.
What did you work on in Saarinen's office? It was a short time, but you must have worked on some schools or something there.
Well, I was in the planning department.
Oh, I see.
Because I did my graduate work there. Yeah. And we did quite a bit of planning work there. Eastern Washtenaw County plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to leave Saarinen. They had me earmarked for as a planner, and I wanted to get into architecture again.
I see.
And it was hard for me to break into it. It wasn't a big office. It was about maybe 40 men.
Oh, that's still quite large.
Still pretty good, A lot of nice people in that office. Eero was finally made a partner while I was there.
Is that right?
Yeah, he was.
Were any of the other Cranbrook grads that we know about, the Eames or Bertoia, were they ever in Saarinen's office with you?
No.
No.
No, they were independent.
Yeah.
They were more designers.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Eames was definitely a designer in the sense that he got into furniture manufacturing,
right?
Furniture design. Although he did his own house, which is nice, very nice house. He and his wife, Ray Eames.
Yeah. She was at Cranbrook as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was a student. They were a year or two ahead of me. But there's, I like Mies. I wanted to go study with Mies.
Oh, yeah.
But I was scared of him.
Why is that?
Well, there's nobody coming out of Mies's office that you put your finger on. Not at that time. Whereas Cranbrook had a bunch of strange names coming out. Rapson.
Oh, yeah.
Ralph Rapson. Harry Weiss.
Mm-hmm.
They're all doing things on their own. Charlie Eames.
Yeah.
Bertoia. And it was a very small school. 6-7 students, that's about it.
A lot of attention.
Yeah, a lot of attention. So I went with Cranbrook and never regretted it.
Oh, yeah. It's a beautiful campus.
It is. It's a beautiful, it's idyllic, It's just a dream. It's a rich man's dream.
Mm.
Something I wasn't used to, but I grew fond of it.
Would you like to stop there and take a little break?
Let's do that.